Judging by the conversation, the breakfast with a few people, maybe there's more to said about DMT than what we said yesterday. Does anybody? I think these things are most productive when driven by question rather than somebody jawing. Is there anyone who wants to ask a question? Or extend what was said yesterday or before breakfast this morning?
Concerned about how was one going to, since it's not easy to get it commercially, on preparing, and it will give you the experience comparable to.
I'm not a chemist, and I dare say these things, it's dangerous. These things use reactive solvents and stuff like that. It's possible that out of the set of plants that the ayahuasca analogs compared, that it could concentrate DMT out of Desmanthus elegansis or Socotria or Phoris or something like that. For those of us who aren't second-year students in biochemistry, this is probably the way to go. The other way to go is to try and find a chemist and inspire them to make. I mean, it's not a terribly satisfying answer, but on the other hand, if there were a terribly satisfying answer, there wouldn't be a question, would there?
Talk about concentrating it in the mattress. Just soak it. Off the water.
No, the way you would do it, if you were serious, is you would get this apparatus called oxalate extractor, SOXLEB. This is a piece of chemical glassware. And the way it works is it has a bulb. You hook it, plug it in through a ground glass fitting. You plug it to your solvent vessel, which is sitting in a heater, and it vaporizes the solvent. Solvent is carried through a tube past the slit and up into a condenser. The solvent then liquefies. It drips down onto the sample, which is in a little thing which looks sort of like a condom or a toilet paper tube, something anyway. It's a cylinder with a rounded end pack with the sample that you're extracting. And the soxlet, which was undoubtedly designed in Germany by somebody very clever, this hot solvent falls on the sample, and the sample gets more and more immersed in the solvent. Well, then when the solvent is above the level of the little sampling filter tube, there's a pipe on the side of the slit which leads back down into the tube vessel on the heater, and a kind of siphon automatic cuts in. It's a passing, it's just how it's designed. And the hot solvent goes and it just sucks all the salt off the sample and drops it back in the lower flask. And then the hot solvent begins pure, nothing dissolved in it, because you know when a solvent vaporizes, it leaves all their materials behind. And you run this, like refluxing, you flux the sample for 2 or 3 hours, and at the end of that time, you can be fairly confident, if you've chosen your salt correctly, that 99% of what was is down in the flask. And just unhook the solvent flask from the apparatus, take that, and evaporate it. And then you get this is called the liquid that flask is called the mother liquid. It is a whole alkaloid extract. Every alkaloid in the sample is now in solution in this stuff. Then you can either simply drive the solvent off and you'll get probably a dark brown, reddish brown tar of some sort you can smoke. Or if you really are I saw a guy smoke DMT in the forest in Hawaii, and these metallic bugs came and hovered right over him for the entire trip. And you have this red tar which you can smoke, but if you want only the DMT and want to separate it from the other alkaloids, then there's a further series of steps, which is you get chromatography paper, you know what this is? And you put the solvent into like a petri dish, suspend the chromatography page so that it just touches solvent. And you all know and understand the pulls of chromatography?
Doesn't it wick up the surface?
Yeah, wicks up through the paper, which is very porous, and compounds of different molar weights will deposit themselves at different levels in the chromatography paper. And then with an ultraviolet light, or sometimes you can tell with your naked eye, it depends on what you're looking for, the DET will all, like say, DET will be at 3.5 inches, the DMT will be at 4 inches, monomethyl DMT will be above that. In other words, they fractionate out. And then what you do this, and you save your chromatography papers, and then when you've used up all your mother liquor in this way, you take a pair of scissors and you go through, cut out the inch wide strip or all the DMT located in the filter paper. And so then you get a bunch of little pieces of paper which are saturated in DMT. Now you put them in a clean, this thing, this condom-like filter. It looks like a bullet. The little sheet chromatography paper in there, run a solvent through that, and this time when you iterate off the solvent, you will a pure compound for your purpose. I mean, it will be 99% pure DMT. I mean, this sounds like a lot of hassle. On the other hand, about the key to the mystery of life and death here, so the effort doesn't seem too heroic.
You're talking about a solvent. What solvent to use?
Well, you can look this up in a standard chemistry book. The cautionary word here is that high molecular weight solvents are flammable. Chloroform, ether, use these things very carefully, always in an open and well-ventilated place. And for God's sake, don't heat your flat on a gas stove. No open flames. Use a hot plate or something like that. Professional chemists have what are called bird nest heaters, which are these things which look like bird nests of various sizes that the flask of solvent just nicely snuggles down into the bird nest heater and make sure that there are no unwounded electrical connections around. Ideally, it should be done outside where the moving air can disperse solvent. You don't want to make a fuel of yourself.
This morning, since DMT is so difficult, that psilocybin, if you have more than 8 grams or 8 grams at least, that you would similar or the same effect. Then,
well, I said sometimes on high dose psilocybin, sitting in darkness, breathing and worked, massaging it for hours, you can break to these places. But if there's a number of extraneous issues here, the one thing about the DMT flash, it's mercifully quick, so there isn't any time to panic or begin to think about the implications of it. It's just a white knuckle chip through it, and then you're out. I think my technique is to try and inspire chemists to make it, and I always tell people, say, where do you get it? I always say, when you find it, call me first. And chemists, I say, when you make it, call me first. And I think this is an effective method for those of us who aren't inspired biochemists. Want us to somehow the influence of DMT and to a lesser degree psilocybin. They want us to experiment with language. They want us to, this is my intuition. I think that we're, yesterday at the end, talking about how we're on the brink of logical transformation, which from something seen to something beheld. There's some kind of coalescence of linguistic intent that they want to catalyze. The way I think of these psychedelic compounds is that they are enzymes which catalyze the imagination. A catalyst, is a thing which you add to a chemical reaction to speed it up. And I think that consciousness might well have evolved out of higher hominids than 30, 40, 50 million years, but it happened in 2 million years. And to account for that, I think we have to look for a catalyst of the imagination. And that's what these things do. And they give your mind becomes a much more powerful tool for the forming of association, for the producing of imagery, for, I mean, your mind becomes like discriminating wisdom of the sword of Manjri. You're just able to cut through. Consciousness expansion is what things were associated with. And I say in my talks, absence of consciousness killing the planet. So if there's something that we can do to accelerate our consciousness, then it seems to me there's almost a moral and political obligation to do that.
One thing that I find interesting that in the Amazon, the indigenous ayahuasqueros, what the difference is, they have no doubt in their mind that is a people to this world, or that is the visions they have, or the spirit speaking to them, or whatever. Like some ayahuasqueros, telling him where the gold was, where the gold and this and that, but he was saying that was a kuri, where the woman of gold, the spirit of gold. And I'm just thinking that other young that drink ayahuasca, they say that their tapalo, they're covered, their eyes are covered, they don't see the visions that the master ayahuasca will see, which are usually just, beautiful visions of spirits telling them this and that. And maybe it's mid fasting and the initiation that the shamans that I go through in order to get to it, they can see these warnings is preparing the body enough to receive, to be able to get into that state on my concentrations of fatigue. Maybe it's because we haven't gone through that initiation, or that our bodies aren't adapted to that we higher dose or a more direct concentration. But I think it's maybe what developed in order to get to the point of these things is some way of preparing the body to get into that state with the concentration, with the things available to them.
I think, well, it's not something I think, it's so that the body is an incredibly sensitive and delicate instrument for interacting with the world. For instance, an example that I like to use, some of you may remember from when you were children, you got a really good chemist set. There would be a thing in it called a spintharoscope. Do you all know what a thoroscope is? Could make one of these. They're really neat. You could make one. This seems to be the 4 of the morning. You could make one with a paper tube from the inside of a roll of toilet paper. What a spintharoscope is, it's a little pot, usually no longer than, and in one end it has a lens. And in the other, it has a painted for a screen, like a vision set, but just a